Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present author and activist Jonathan Schell, who explains why he and other veterans of the anti-nuclear movement have issued an urgent call to limit and eventually abolish nuclear weapons. John Humphreys, who recently returned from an American Friends Service Committee delegation to Iraq, reflects on conditions he found inside Iraq and the consequences of any future U.S. war against Baghdad. And Frank O'Donnell, executive director of the Clean Air Trust, who explains why he believes the Bush administration's Clear Skies initiative will dismantle critical components of the Clean Air Act. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Every morning, sick Haitians line up for help at a health clinic in the rural village of Kangay. They come out of the mountains and often camp and wait for the clinic to open. The medical clinic was started 20 years ago by American doctor Paul Farmer, a Harvard-educated researcher. The clinic offers aid to people with HIV/AIDS and tuberculosis. In recent years, Farmer has attracted international attention by insisting that people in poor nations should be offered advanced AIDS treatments and antiretroviral drugs. According to the New Internationalist magazine, Farmer bases his treatment on the model used to fight drug-resistant tuberculosis. The clinic in Kangay started treating pregnant women with HIV with the drug AZT in 1995. 2 years later, the triple anti-AIDS cocktail was given to rape victims. Like treating TB, the AIDS cocktail requires patients to take several drugs a day and substitute drugs where resistance develops. Today, Farmer dismisses worries that drug resistance to advanced HIV drugs will mushroom in developing countries. He says it is just another excuse not to provide AIDS treatment to patients in impoverished nations like Haiti. At the Haitian clinic, 65 people with advanced AIDS now take the triple cocktail treatment. They are gaining strength and follow the regime closely, although there are some side effects. Meanwhile, millions of people with AIDS are waiting to be treated in developing nations around the world. The World Press Review magazine reports that U.S. Marines are on the ground in the rainforest province of Misiones in Argentina, which borders Brazil and Paraguay. Officially, the American Marines are there to combat a mosquito, Aedes aegypti, that carries deadly dengue fever. According to Argentine press reports, the Marines are working with area health agencies to research the mosquito, but the U.S. government openly states that there are military applications in the mission. The initiative is being paid for by the World Bank with the aim to control and monitor infectious diseases. The U.S. Marines are part of the Peru-based U.S. Naval Medical Research Attachment set up in 1983 to research infectious diseases. But this is not just a public health exercise. The website of the U.S. Embassy in Peru states the first priority of this project is to detect risk of infectious diseases for American military forces. Misiones, capital city of Puerto Iguazu, is one of intense interest to American intelligence because of its location on the Three Borders area, a suspected terrorist sanctuary. The U.S. military set up another public health program in Argentina in the Azul region in the early 1980s. This was at the peak of the Contra War in Central America. Animal tests were done using rabies and smallpox, yet the project was classified and the testing center was guarded by American troops. The center was closed in 1986 after an inquiry by the Argentine Ministry of Health and Social Welfare. Soon afterwards, the center's files disappeared and were never found. The center's work remains a secret. Los Angeles janitor Mario Luna is a victim of predatory lending. Looking to pay off an overdue debt, he took out a loan with Household Financial Services, the nation's largest mortgage lender. The janitor ended up getting fleeced. He had a new 30-year, $500,000 mortgage on his house he bought for $107,000 in 1996. He also got hit by $11,000 in upfront fees and had to pay a 10.8% interest rate, far above the prime rate. Luna is now fighting back. He contacted Acorn and testified before the L.A. City Council for a tough anti-predatory lending law. Acorn has targeted Household Financial Services with a national direct action campaign. Other consumer groups are pushing for state and local anti-predatory lending ordinances. According to The Nation magazine, the majority of victims of predatory lending are low-income African Americans, Latinos, and whites with checkered credit histories. they need to go to the subprime credit market, where they are hit by 10 to 13% interest rates and high fees. In response to local laws like the ones pushed by Acorn in Oakland, California, and Philadelphia, lenders are working to weaken state laws and overturn pro-consumer lending ordinances. The bankers succeeded in getting the Pennsylvania legislature to revoke the Philadelphia law and won an exemption from the state fair practices law. But low-income activists prevailed in Chicago, where Mayor Richard Daley backed anti-predatory lending legislation as a way to combat abandoned housing. Daley then used his clout in the state capitol, where Governor George Ryan also adopted stiff anti-predatory lending rules. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
Despite the end of the Cold War a decade ago, the danger of nuclear war and the human catastrophe which such a conflict could inflict on the planet has not diminished. In recent months, India and Pakistan have both threatened to use their nuclear arsenals in any future conflict over the disputed territory of Kashmir. The Bush administration, in their drive for military superiority, have abandoned arms control treaties and embarked on deployment of a controversial missile defense system, proposed the development of new battlefield nuclear weapons, and threatened to use nukes against non-nuclear states. In June, several veterans of the anti-nuclear weapons movement of the 1980s issued an urgent call to end the nuclear danger. Drafted by author Jonathan Schell, Free's campaign organizer Randy Forsberg, and former director of SANE David Courtwright, the call is an initiative to engage and educate a broad public about the growing danger that nuclear weapons will be used and about practical steps to reduce that danger. The document, first published in The Nation magazine and circulated on the Internet, demands that the U.S. and Russia fulfill their commitments under the Non-Proliferation Treaty together with the other nuclear powers, step by carefully inspected and verified step to the abolition of nuclear weapons. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Jonathan Schell, author of The Fate of the Earth, who explains why the urgent call was issued now and his hope that a new anti-nuclear weapons movement can be organized to counter the threat of nuclear conflict.
The time is right now because there's really a kind of nuclear revival going on. The administration is planning new uses of nuclear weapons. They're threatening first use of nuclear weapons. They're scrapping the policies of the Cold War of deterrence and containment, which were flawed enough, replacing them with worse and more dangerous policies of preemption. It's not my word, it's theirs, of attacking first, something that's against the traditions of this country, brought up on the stories of Pearl Harbor. And it's a formula for military engagement, for war, not just in Iraq, but in other parts of the world as well, that explicitly includes the use of nuclear weapons, even in first strikes. And also they're gearing up the whole nuclear establishment behind the sort of cover of this rather deceptive treaty. They're asking for new types of nuclear weapons. One is called the Robust Earth Penetrator. It sounds like something Dr. Strangelove made up, a kind of a joke, but that's the actual name they give it. And so nuclear weapons are back, and nuclear danger is back, and we've got to come back to and protest it.
The leaders of this country, our political leaders, sell the idea of military superiority as a must, a necessity to protect this country. And particularly after September 11th, you have many people very, if not sympathetic to that whole notion, enthusiastic endorsers of the notion that this country should be an unrivaled, unchallenged superpower with military dominance right down the line, from outer space weapons to the latest nuclear blockbuster bombs.
I don't think that the public is as hawkish as the administration makes out, actually. I don't think that it's really a warlike public. Nevertheless, people think, yes, we'll be very powerful, we'll be safe. But all they have to do is think for a moment and ask themselves, if some other country were saying that we alone, would have this superiority and military power, and the U.S. just had to do what we said. I tell you, people would not like it here in this country, and they don't like it around the world either. So this provokes anger. This provokes hostility. People don't like to be pushed around. Let me read you something that President Bush said in a speech. He said, America has and intends to keep military strengths beyond challenge, thereby making the destabilizing arms races of other eras pointless, limiting rivalries to trade and other pursuits of peace. In other words, we're going to be so strong that no one else is even going to be able to think about challenging us in military. Imagine if we heard Germany has and intends to keep military strengths beyond challenge and so forth. We'd put our defense spending from $400 billion up to $800 billion. We wouldn't stand for that for a minute. But people around the world are not so different from us that way. They want equity. They want justice. They want to participate. They want to be the masters of their own fate. They don't want a big global nanny telling them what they can do and what they can't do, global policemen, what have you.
After the demise of the Soviet Union, the United States has stood pretty much alone as the remaining superpower. And as you're saying here, people react with the view that the United States has become very arrogant now in this, with the pulling out of many international treaties and going its own way on so many issues. Is there a vacuum now in terms of, you know, some rival for the United States that will invite a coalition of nations, military buildup by one or two nations that will fill the vacuum of the old Soviet Union? Are you concerned that we may have another new Cold War on our hands at some point because of the U.S. Swaggering around the world like it has?
I think it is provocative, and it does arouse hostility. It may not be a Cold War. It may be that people will choose economic retaliation. It may be that they will refuse to cooperate with us in things that we want, including the war on terror, so-called. We may find that the doors are closing in our faces around the world. It arouses hostility, and that's not good for the United States. We need to do business in the world. We need to be in cooperation with the world. Our interests are bound up with the world. We can't just push people around.
Just a final question. We have seen a lot of activism in this country and around the world that we haven't seen in several decades. A big part of that has been a global social justice movement that's challenged corporate-led globalization. And more recently, with the conflict in the Middle East and the war on terrorism, we've seen the emergence somewhat of a new peace movement. Do you see the prospects in the near term of a new strengthened peace movement that will merge in some ways with an economic agenda that's already being pursued by a lot of groups worldwide?
I think that has to happen. A world of escalating war is not going to be a world of economic justice. Look at the powers that are pushing the military policy here in the United States. You can forget about your agenda for economic justice if we go down the path of a militarized world and find ourselves in five or six wars. Look at the militarization of the United States, you know, since September 11th. That's a dangerous path. So we've got to join up in this. It really is two aspects of a single cause, in my opinion.
That was author and activist Jonathan Schell. Contact those organizing the urgent call at area code 617-354-4337 or visit their website at www.urgentcall.org. The Bush administration almost daily pronounces its intention to the world that the U.S. is preparing for regime change in Iraq, a now well-worn euphemism for a future American invasion to overthrow the government of Saddam Hussein. While the date of such an attack is uncertain, Pentagon documents leaked to the press indicate that a U.S. assault might come early next year. Although the administration's justification for an attack on Baghdad is based on the unproven allegation that Saddam Hussein possesses or is developing weapons of mass destruction, there are growing concerns that Washington's war talk is damaging diplomatic efforts to return U.N. weapons inspectors back into Iraq. European and Arab governments are also fearful of the instability which could be triggered in the Middle East if American troops invade Iraq while violence between Israelis and Palestinians continues unabated. Recent congressional hearings, while skewed toward those voicing support for a strike against Iraq, have raised some important questions about U.S. war plans. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with John Humphreys, who recently returned from an American Friends Service Committee delegation to Iraq. His group, which traveled within Iraq from May 30th to June 13th, visited hospitals, schools, and development projects funded by the Quaker Group. Humphreys reflects on conditions he observed inside Iraq and the possible consequences of a future U.S. war against Baghdad.
I think that the majority of Iraqis, I think, have a fatalistic attitude in a lot of ways. They think, given the rhetoric coming from our government, there's a sense that it's going to happen. And we heard from Iraqi government officials, you know, defiant statements of what can they do to us that they haven't already done, that the U.S. continues to bomb them, that we have seen, you know, deaths of hundreds of thousands, some estimates million or more Iraqis due to the sanctions. On the other hand, people on the streets, when we were talking with them, we would identify ourselves as American, and they would say, well, oh, you know, welcome, what are you doing here? I had some Arabic language ability and was able to just convey to folks that we were there to try to make peace between the Iraqi people and the American people, and, you know, apologies for what our government was doing. And typical response was given to me by a man that I met down in Basra, and he just, you know, shrugged his shoulders and put his hands up in the air and said, well, you know, what can we do? My response was, well, you know, I'm here to see, and I can go back and speak and share what I've seen. And he said, I think they won't listen. And our experience was that since the Iraqi people have no experience or expectation of being able to influence the policies of their own government, they don't hold us accountable for the actions and policies of our government. So there's a real sense that what will happen, and that they will have to bear it. On the other hand, there was real sense of pleading with us to try to make a difference, because they recognized that renewed active warfare and an invasion would create tremendous hardship in the country. One of the things, going back to the average teacher, UNICEF estimates that an average teacher's effective income at this point, that 80% of the monthly income comes through the Oil for Food program food basket. And this is food that is imported, paid for by the sale of Iraqi oil, and then distributed to every family in the country. In the event of airstrikes or an invasion, that food distribution system will undoubtedly be disrupted. What I learned from this is that that is the mechanism through which we will see the tremendous human tragedy from this war in Iraq, on the scale that we saw in Afghanistan, through the combination of drought and warfare and the hundreds of thousands of refugees in Afghanistan.
John, I would ask you to review for us what you feel some of the consequences regionally and internationally if the U.S. was to go ahead with an invasion of Iraq, as we're hearing often from the White House.
I think the concern here is that regardless of what you or I believe in terms of the causes for the deaths of Iraqi civilians, the relevant thing here is the view in the Middle East. And our government's policies, both in terms of the sanctions for which we are blamed for these deaths, and in terms of the talk about overthrowing Saddam Hussein, you know, the regime change talk, and talk of an invasion, all provides fodder and pieces of the puzzle of resentment in the region toward the U.S. The U.S. has refused to pursue any diplomatic efforts, so that it looks like, you know, the U.S. is intent on provoking another war. All of these actions are giving fuel to the Islamic fundamentalists. And one of the ways I've expressed this is that just as our government and our media are demonizing Saddam Hussein, we are providing the means for Islamic fundamentalists to demonize George Bush and our government and provide a recruiting mechanism for the fundamentalists and the terrorists.
What, in your view, should activists, peace activists, be doing now in the face of what we're told is an inevitable war, a war between the U.S. and Iraq?
Well, I think the number one priority right now is to engage people in dialogue. Just as we need to be seeing dialogue at the international level, seeking diplomatic resolutions to the tensions, what needs to happen here at home is that we need an active dialogue and debate, and we need to engage people around us, people who have diverse views, who don't agree with us, and just raise these difficult questions about what would be the impact on the region, how would that make the world a safer place for Americans. I mean, we need to get people to ask those difficult questions to understand that there are no simplistic solutions.
That was John Humphreys of the American Friends Service Committee. Contact the committee at area code 215-241-7000 or visit their website at www.afsc.org. The Bush administration's proposal to clean up dirty power plants is dubbed the Clear Skies Initiative. It proposes to reduce air pollution by as much as 70% by capping emissions of smog-producing nitrogen oxide, acid rain-generating sulfur dioxide, and mercury, which is toxic even in minute quantities, especially to pregnant women. The linchpin of this plan is emissions credit trading, which would allow power plants that exceed the cap to buy credits from plants that produce less pollution. Most environmental organizations oppose this because it does nothing to clean up the air around the plants. Meanwhile, Democrats in Congress are supporting a plan introduced by independent Senator Jim Jeffords that would clean up the three pollutants targeted in the Clear Skies proposal, but also tackle global warming through the reduction of carbon dioxide emissions, something the Bush plan ignores. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Frank O'Donnell, executive director of the Clean Air Trust, a bipartisan organization dedicated to protecting the Clean Air Act. He says the Bush plan will dismantle critical components of the Clean Air Act and explains that other practical options exist for improving air quality.
President Bush has proposed what can best be described as an industry-friendly plan that would repeal much of the current Clean Air Act as it affects big electric power plants, and replace it instead with a plan under which big electric power companies could buy and sell the right to pollute to each other. Overall, the president is saying that he projects emissions would come down in the future. We question some of the math that he's used based on our own analysis of the legislation. We think that really this is using kind of an Arthur Anderson-style accounting technique under which the president is not counting the benefits that you would achieve by enforcement of the current Clean Air Act. And in fact, the plan itself is a carbon copy of a plan that was proposed last year by Enron, believe it or not, before it hit all its financial troubles, a plan that it wanted because it wanted the freedom to buy and sell the right to pollute. We think it's, on the whole, it's a big step back for clean air. And it's one that we fear will actually encourage irresponsible corporations to become more irresponsible because it will give them more opportunities to escape cleanup and more opportunities to evade the law.
You were talking about, I guess, emission credit trading when you were talking about, you know, different plants who can't meet the requirements
right.
for clean air could basically, you know, buy credits from a plant that was cleaner
right.
than what was required. Now, that's been in effect for quite a while. Isn't that true? And isn't it also true that a number of environmental groups actually support that as a way to get overall cleaner air?
Well, there have been some limited efforts with emission trading, and the track record is very mixed. The example the Bush administration often points to is the so-called acid rain provisions of the 1990 Clean Air Act, under which electric power companies were supposed to reduce their sulfur dioxide emissions. It has reduced emissions, and it has done so at levels less costly than power companies claimed back in 1990, back when they were using scare tactics to try to prevent any kind of cleanup. However, it has failed to accomplish its goal. There's still acid rain and lakes are still dying from it, so it can't be called an unqualified success. Many environmental groups support this idea as it pertains particularly to global pollution like carbon dioxide, which doesn't have any kind of localized impact. It's a global, universal kind of an issue. And emission trading there, if it can be verifiable, might make some sense. But we're talking about local pollutants that can cause local public health damage. We think that you need to retain some local safeguards. And the president's plan would get rid of those.
What is the status of his proposal now? Does it need to go through the Congress to get approval? And are there other plans that are proposed in Congress that would be more protective of clean air as your organization sees it?
Right now, the president has proposed legislation that is not going to be enacted this year. We think, because they know that, the White House knows this, that it is largely a smokescreen to enable the Bush administration through regulation to relax parts of the rules that currently govern coal-fired electric power plants and other big sources of pollution like refineries, pulp and paper mills, and other smokestack industries. They are proceeding ahead with relaxing the rules for these plants under the current law, we think illegally, and they'll be sued for doing it, but they're going ahead with this. At least in the short term, it's going to allow these factories to actually increase their pollution. There is a bill that has, in fact, been passed by a Senate committee that environmentalists like. It, in fact, retains all the current aspects of the Clean Air Act and takes it one step farther by requiring, under a very strict timetable, additional reductions in emissions from these pollutants, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, and mercury. And in fact, it says by a certain date in the future, every existing plant in the country has to install the best available pollution control technology. And this is the plan that Senator Jeffords of Vermont has championed. It narrowly was approved by his committee. It's going to face very tough sledding because of the combined might of the coal and electric power industries. It, unlike the Bush administration plan, would call for a reduction in carbon dioxide, which is a principal emission that's linked to heat-trapping global warming. The Bush administration plan does nothing about this and, in fact, would make global warming worse.
That was Frank O'Donnell, executive director of the Clean Air Trust. Contact the trust at area code 202-785-9625 or visit their website at www.cleanairtrust.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Sasha Summer-Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.